Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as the Ebola outbreak in West Africa continues to spread and with no cure and a high mortality rate, word comes that one strategy being put in place dates back to the days of the Black Death in Europe, cordoning off the areas most effective to prevent the disease's spread. Donald G. McNeil, Jr., science and health reporter for the New York Times, wrote about the return of what's called the cordon sanitaire, and he joins me now here in the studio. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
Cordon sanitaire.
Sanitary cordon, sanitary barrier. The term dates, from, as far as I could tell in doing research for the article, from 1821, when the French used it to describe sending 30,000 troops into the Pyrenees to keep a fever that was raging through Spain from crossing the border.
Were there other famous instances of it?
Yeah, there's lots. I mean, remember, in the era before antibiotics and vaccines and things, it's in a sort of extreme form of quarantine. People are sometimes familiar with quarantine, which is a ship would sail into a harbor originally in Italy, and it would be held with no one able to get on or no one able to get off for 40 days. That's where we get the term quarantine, quarante. A cordon sanitaire is an even more extreme thing where you try to close off an entire area, say an entire city, and let no one out. In the old days, until the disease just burned itself out and people were either left to live or die or maybe starve if you didn't send food into them. Now it's extremely rare. I didn't see any instances since 1918 when the eastern border of Poland was closed so that typhus in the Soviet Union couldn't come out. And you'd need to run it a little more humanely. You can't just let people starve inside and die inside. Instead, you leave it open enough to get food and water and medical.
Is that why it fell out of favor? Because it didn't respect individuals enough if you were cordoning off a whole community like that?
Because it could be murder if you enforce it.
Just so, to put a fine point on it. So why are they doing it here?
Well, about 70% of the cases are all in this area where Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia meet. It's where the disease first broke out, and there's a lot of transmission within families. There's also a lot of fear of people going to field hospitals. They believe that MSF and the others are bringing in the virus. So the three countries involved decided that they would throw up roadblocks around that entire area, not closing their borders, but closing off the whole triangular area where the cases are concentrated and not let anyone out unless they go through pretty severe temperature checks and things like that. But there will be caregivers going in, and eventually there presumably will be food and water going in too.
And as I understand it, one of the complicating factors is that it's happening in a region that's divided up between several countries, right at that spot where Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea meet. And those are all countries whose civil infrastructure has been damaged by civil wars.
And, I mean, even without the civil wars, the area is a mess. If you see the pictures coming out of there, it's rainy season. The roads are mud. It's mud 2 feet thick. MSF vehicles get dragged through it by tow trucks and things like that. It's really hard to get around in there. It's really hard to set up field hospitals or anything. And it's hard for people to get in and out.
So there's no money, no infrastructure, no cure, no trust in the government. But they do have militaries. So
yes.
This cordon sanitaire relies on roadblocks and physical barricades primarily?
Yes, that's basically it. It's basically sort of a series of military roadblocks with there are roadblocks all over Africa, and how porous they are depends on a lot of things, including how determined the president is that they stay closed and also whether or not you can pay a bribe to get through them. But these are areas with a lot of very poor farmers, and I don't suppose a lot of people are going to be bribing their way out.
Are doctors and other medical professionals going in? Because we know that what's been different about this Ebola outbreak than previous ones is the prevalence of the disease striking some of those medical professionals.
Yes, they can get in and get out. They have to go through checkpoints to show that they have the right credentials. They have to have their temperatures checked and things. This is all new, so it's not clear how it's going. They really need not just doctors, but they need thousands of people who would get in there and trace contacts of every single person who's got the disease, and that's one of the crucial parts of closing down an epidemic. And people are afraid to go in there because so many have gotten sick and died.
And are they going in? I mean, do they have enough health workers who are going in? Or do you know?
I'm not there. I'm in New York City. The reporter I talked to, our guy Adam Nasser, who was there, said, look, there was nobody else on the road. But he saw an MSF truck going through at the time he was there. But there's not nearly enough. Every every agency trying to do something about this is overstretched, is way over the limits of what it's capable of doing. The epidemic is overwhelming. That's why they're using this radical tactic.
Who is taking the lead at this point?
The World Health Organization is nominally in charge, but, you know, Doctors Without Borders, and now the CDC has just sent 50 people to the area. Usually these epidemics, these outbreaks of Ebola are shut down in a village with just teams coming in and using local health workers. There have been about 20 Ebola outbreaks since 1976 when it was discovered, and this is the first time that the outbreak has gotten so much bigger that it's completely overwhelmed the normal response.
So how many people did you say are in this cordoned off area? Did you give me a number?
I didn't give you a number. I'm not sure. The area is, you know, maybe the size of New Jersey. So that's a lot.
Whoa.
And imagine trying to feed all of New Jersey while closing off its borders.
They're having trouble enough with that in New Jersey.
Exactly.
Is there an end date that's considered likely?
No. I mean, everybody.
How do they know when this is over?
They don't. The epidemic, sorry, I shouldn't call it an epidemic. It's technically still an outbreak. I mean, you know, it's a few thousand cases. The cases have, there have been numerous. I think there are about 100 cases just in the last couple of days. I'd have to go back and look at the WHO figures. But the cases are still increasing, particularly in Sierra Leone and Liberia. And when you impose a quarantine or any kind of close off, you normally wait two full incubation periods after the last case to say that, all right, the outbreak is over. Well, the incubation period for Ebola on the outside is 21 days, so that would theoretically mean 42 days after the last case is when you could finally say, okay, that's it, it's over.
I'm still struggling with the ethics of this just by listening to the details that you're giving and putting the dots together. You say, I mean, you're the one who said it's murder to have this cordon sanitaire. If people are not getting treated or if the healthy are not let out in some way. But you also said that there's a shortage of medical professionals to go in and treat everybody. So why isn't this murder?
It's a dicey situation. If it goes on for weeks and weeks and food doesn't get in and people inside have already started to complain that food prices are rising and they can't make any – traders who need to go in and out to reach market towns and stuff can't make money. They can't buy food for their families. It's the rainy season. Farmers aren't bringing in new crops. It could get – if they enforce the cordon brutally, people could starve. I assume that since the world is watching – you know, the World Health Organization said, look, you know, this has to be done with respect for human rights if it's done. The CDC and the WHO have kind of kept their hands off this one. They haven't endorsed it. They haven't condemned it either. And they weren't part of the announcement. It was announced by the three countries themselves. The CDC and the WHO know perfectly well that things could go very wrong and that this is a really radical step. And they've said it's got to be done in such a way that human rights are respected. So that means the World Food Program is going to have to get in there and give and make sure that food gets in. That means medical care is going to have to get in. The dicey thing is once you let people in, okay, fine. When do you let them out? You don't want healthcare workers who have gotten infected while inside the cordon bringing the disease out. So you have to very carefully control who goes in and who goes out. It's not just the locals who are being penned in that need to be controlled. It's the healthcare workers coming
right
out too.
But another irony then is that lack of public health resources also makes it particularly risky from an ethical perspective.
Correct. And it's not like people are – well, some people are volunteering to go because people have good hearts, but many people are afraid to go too.
Well, some of the medical and ethical issues raised by the cordon sanitaire in the center of the Ebola outbreak area in Africa, the first one used in nearly 100 years. Donald G. McNeil, Jr., who covers science and health for The New York Times, thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, attention job hunters. One of the masters at helping people find work and choose careers is about to join us. That's Richard Bowles, author of What Color Is Your Parachute, which is out in a new edition. We'll open up the phones and see how he can help some of you. Stay with us.